marketplace that exists only along the Miami River, a woman forced to give birth behind bars, and a piece of a new Keys resort goes up in flames. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. There are all sorts of boats that go through the Miami River. Some of them are operating in an industry made up of trash. It's Miamians taking our waste and sending it to Haiti for a second life. We'll look deeper into that industry. Also, a female inmate in a Broward County jail recently gave birth by herself in her cell. There's now an investigation into why the inmate didn't get proper care. What sort of health care do inmates have the right to receive, and what are they actually getting? And we'll go down to the Florida Keys to look at the case of the fire that destroyed part of a beach resort and a Coral Springs developer accused of dumping construction waste after Hurricane Irma. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. So how often do you look over at the boats that are chugging along the rivers of your community? Have you ever asked what's on those boats? Along the Miami River, there's an industry that operates that takes much of the things that we Miamians consider old or we just throw out, and it takes those things to Haiti where they find new life. In a new piece published for the June issue of Harper's Magazine, out now, Rowan Moore Garrity looks into this industry and the role that it plays for the communities in Haiti and their diaspora here in South Florida. Now, we've shared photos from his reporting on our Facebook page at WLRN Sundial, and you may know Rowan from his time as WLRN's education reporter. He continues to work with us as a freelance editor. Rowan joins us now. Rowan, great to talk to you again, man.
Yeah, good to hear your voice, Luis.
All right, tell us real quick about the different parts of the river. Where along the Miami River you find these ports where these ships are being loaded and unloaded with cargo that's going back and forth between us and Haiti?
The river's headwaters, if you can call them that, are sort of right south of the Miami airport. And from there, it kind of snakes through Little Havana and Brickell out to the Biscayne Bay. And if you've ever driven across one of those drawbridges, you might have gotten a glimpse. But basically, there are two roads that line either side of it and some old railroad tracks. And on either side are these big blacktop shipyards and warehouses. And many of them are loading freighters that are headed for Haiti. And some, go ahead.
Yeah, yeah, and you describe beautifully. I mean, I'm trying to picture these. I guess I drive by them and I don't even think about it. Like these big spaces and warehouses where you've got everything from cars, mattresses, rice, doors, all kinds of stuff.
It is hard to describe. It is... just a feast for the eyes when you walk through the gate of one of these places. Usually the first sign that you're near a shipping terminal is there will be a bunch of cars parked in the turning lane. And yeah, some of them will have a paint marker on their windshield saying whether they've paid the customs duty or not. But you walk in and it's just as you say, you know, there's stacks of wheelbarrows and old ladders and cases of ramen and Powerade and, you know, motorcycle engines and bicycles and, you know, bundles of used clothes bound together. So it's really kind of everything you can think of. And it's a mix of staple household goods, soap, rice, beans, oil, and so forth, and this huge variety of secondhand goods that basically, for one reason or another, someone in the U.S. has made the decision, it's not going to be worth it to get somebody here, to pay somebody here, in other words, to deal with it. So this window frame or that door or this old plywood or this old mattress may still have some value somewhere. But by the time I hire a guy or a company, even in aggregate, to deal with 200 of them, it's just not worth it. And so we throw them out. And of course, taxpayers are paying for that in one way or another. But there's a huge Haitian diaspora throughout South Florida. A lot of people have very close family ties to rural cities in Haiti where it's a lot harder to get a hold of these consumer goods. And so this whole industry has kind of blossomed around harvesting that junk, for lack of a better term, and finding a way to either send it home to family as some kind of a remittance or gift, or even, you know, in the form of a specialized business, you know, reselling mattresses, reselling old appliances.
You highlighted a couple of different people in this story. Who is Jean-Claude, and I apologize if I'm not saying this right, Exantus?
Yeah, Jean-Claude Exantus. He and his wife, Acela, are sort of the business people at the center of this story. They met in the late 90s. Jean-Claude had already actually been living in the U.S. for quite some time. He grew up in a city called Port-au-Paix, which is, if you can picture Haiti as a sort of horseshoe-shaped country, it's at the sort of tip of one of those horseshoe arms.
Okay.
And it's a city that doesn't have much of a road connection to the rest of the country. It is, I mean, I went there on the back of a motorcycle, and it is rough. And so Jean-Claude left Port-au-Paix in the early 1980s, wound up in South Florida, worked, you know, dishwashing jobs, landscaping jobs, eventually became a carpenter on big construction projects. And throughout, he would sort of send stuff back to family members. And when he met Acela, she was already selling mattresses in the marketplace in Port-au-Paix that she would buy directly from people as they came off the boats that were coming from Miami. So when they got married, they, you know, became not just husband and wife, but also business partners. And basically, the way the business works is she runs a storefront in Port-au-Paix where they sell anything and everything that he is able to acquire by one means or another
in
Miami.
Yeah, how is he acquiring this stuff?
Any way he can. I mean, it's funny. When you talk to Jean-Claude about it, he's almost kind of insulted by the question. It's like it's so much part of the fabric of the at least a certain portion of the Haitian diaspora in South Florida that it seems so obvious, right? So he's like, you know, neighbors come and bring stuff to me or tell me. They know that I send stuff to Haiti. He's got relationships. There are all these scrap yards along the Miami River, right? And so when auto body shops are getting rid of these big 55-gallon drums where they put coolant or antifreeze or something, Jean-Claude will go and buy them at $5 or $10 a pop out of the back door, and then he'll sell them to Haiti. And in Haiti, actually, Acela has one full-time employee at the shop, and all that man does is he's basically a blacksmith. He cuts up these steel drums, and he'll cut them into pieces and refashion them into these little stovetops that they use, for charcoal cooking.
They basically take anything that's sent over. I mean, from your piece that I gathered, they take almost anything and they can either refurbish it or they turn it into just about anything they can sell. You know, the other thing too is this. I mean, there's no formal system of tracking. You got people that are just coming in, stuffing all kinds of things on these boats to take over to Haiti. And, you know, in your story, you asked, one of the subjects for a ledger, and they kind of looked at you with a, you know, like, what?
Yeah. So, I mean, the reasons for that are varied, but you're right. So nothing is digitized. Everything is done longhand. The way it works is Jean-Claude, for instance, he's been in the game so long that he is able to ship just using his initials. J-E is his mark. And so every time you look at a package, if it says J-E and it's in Port-au-Paix, there's a very good chance that Jean-Claude is the one who put that on a boat. And so everyone who sends stuff has some kind of, they call them marks. And so you'll see these sort of spray-painted symbols on all the merchandise in Port-au-Paix. It's kind of amazing. You bring stuff in, and then there's this sort of negotiation that happens with the guy they call the tally man, or maybe a woman as well. And so the tally person or the tally man basically takes down notes on what you're sending. You work out a price. It's not a set price. It depends on who you know, as in so many things in life. And you pay for your goods, and then that receipt is on carbon paper, right? And so they've got a notebook and a huge stack of carbon paper, and then you will either send a picture on WhatsApp or somehow contrive to get the information from that receipt to the person who's going to be doing the pickup in Haiti. And a lot of times, people who are sending stuff in volume will actually fly down themselves. But it's a sight to behold, because when you see this stuff going into the boats, and it takes weeks to load these boats,
right,
you just have to kind of stand in awe that they're able to reconnect any of these goods with their rightful owners, and because it is so much stuff and there are so many different people involved.
And as you pointed out, it could be everything from mattresses, drums, barrel drums, steel drums, I should say, cars even. So I'm talking with Rowan Moriarty, freelance journalist based in New York. His new piece in Harper's Magazine out now explores the shipping industry from the Miami River to Haiti, a massive informal flea market of sorts, shipping all kinds of things back and forth. He's joining us now from NPR Studios in New York. It's so interesting, Rowan, that, you know, not too far down you have, obviously, the port of Miami, and you have these massive Panamax ships bringing in millions of tons of supplies. These are very modern, automated systems with very little labor, I should say. And then you have the ports you reported on, and they're using nothing but labor and almost, as you said, it's really nothing computerized. How does that industry continue to go in a modern world? Why hasn't it died away?
So it has died away in many, many places. Shipping containers, when they came on the scene and were popularized, you know, somewhere between 50 and 75 years ago, depending on the place, were really revolutionary because all of a sudden you have this airtight, watertight, you know, identifiable, lockable container that can carry a lot of stuff, and then you don't need to unload any of those things individually. You can just use the sort of big Star Wars-ish creature at any port, you know, these big container lifters, to drop it onto the back of a truck. And so obviously it cuts down costs quite considerably because you just don't have that many people who need to touch any individual piece of merchandise. The thing is that using shipping containers requires a serious infrastructure investments. So the Miami River is 15 feet deep at low tide. You can't bring a Panamax down a channel that's less than 100 feet wide and 15 feet deep. You can't even begin to think about it. And so the way that Miami has held on as a important port is because there are a lot of places throughout the Caribbean, and today it's really mainly Haiti and some of the outlying islands of countries like the Bahamas, where they don't have the money or the infrastructure that to sort of receive shipping container carrying ships. And so what you see if you go to Port-au-Paix, as I did, is the ships come in as close as they can get in the harbor, and they'll anchor about 100 yards offshore.
Yes.
Yeah, so you're laughing probably because you've seen the photos.
Yes.
It's quite remarkable. You see this sort of giant freighter heaped with mattresses and pickup trucks, and then there's a crane on the freighter that will take the cars and a bunch of guys running around to make sure the straps are and chains are arranged right, and it'll lift up the car and pull it off over the water and drop it onto a rotation of these wooden fishing boats that are kind of doing a relay race between the boat and the dock. And then once it gets to the dock, again, everything happens by hand. They roll the cars off these I-beams that they've got on the gunnels of each dinghy. And, you know, if it's a box of, you know, 50-pound box of used clothing, they're handing them, you know, one guy to the next, off the dinghy, onto these, you know, hand-pulled big carts. And it all sort of fans out. And it employs a huge number of people. I mean, not just in South Florida, but obviously in any of these destination ports.
How much of this, though, is being subsidized in any way by the drug trade?
Very Miami question, Lewis. It is no secret to anyone who has lived in South Florida for any amount of time that cocaine is never far from the Miami River of the imagination or, you know, of the real world. And I didn't want to write about cocaine. I mean, you know, I was so fascinated by just driving along, you know, Northwest South River Drive, or if that's the right street. I always get confused with that street name, and seeing, you know, these stacks of bicycles and mattresses and stuff kind of peeking over the fence. But the more I talked to people, the more it became clear that it was really hard to disentangle that. So going back to the 1980s, there have been huge busts along the Miami River involving these freighters that essentially come back to Miami, quote unquote, empty from Haiti. And Haiti is very well placed between Florida and Colombia. And there are governance issues in Haiti, you know, a history of a lot of political turmoil and some pretty high-level corruption that make it so that it's been a place where drug traffickers have found it easy to kind of establish a base.
And the Coast Guard,
particularly
still,
in the Northwest.
The Coast Guard is still checking these boats. Why hasn't the U.S. Port Authority or the Coast Guard or any of the local governments shut this down? Or is it an important business that they need?
So I guess I should let the Coast Guard speak for themselves. They didn't want to talk about cocaine much either. You know, it's a sort of a reality that everybody acknowledges grudgingly. I ended up writing about it, frankly, because the boat that I was writing about, it turned out, is one that its owner had bought from the U.S. government at auction after it had been seized because they found 2,000 pounds of cocaine in the hull in 2016, right? And so it's kind of unavoidable. But there are a lot of jobs that are generated by the sort of legitimate mom-and-pop businesses that send cargo in the other direction. And I think, there are a lot of people who care, who draw their livelihoods, and who want to continue to do so from the industrial activity along the Miami River. And so there has been a lot of tension between the sort of development interests that are building these big condominium towers, gradually moving west from downtown and Brickell into Little Havana. It's waterfront property.
Yeah.
And there are things that have made it harder for people to operate, like the fees that you have to pay, the bond you have to put up just in case they find cargo. There have been threats to shut it down at different points. But, you know, there's a legitimate business case. And anytime there's a bust, you know, it's one actor or a handful of actors in a really, you know, industry with thousands of people who touch it. So,
no, definitely. This is a fascinating story and something that you don't think about as you're driving along the river. As you say, you cross over one of these bridges, you may not even think about what's below you. And still this industry that is not really regulated, but an industry that nonetheless is really an important one for a lot of people. Really fascinating story. Rowan Moore Garrity, again, freelance journalist based in New York. His piece out now in Harper's Magazine, exploring the shipping industry from the Miami River into Haiti. You can find a link to the story, also some of the photos from his story, on our Facebook page at WLRN Sundial. Rowan, always a pleasure, man. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Lewis.
And again, you may recognize him. He's our former education reporter, still works as a freelance editor for WLRN, and he was joining us from the NPR studios in New York. Well, still to come, what sort of access to health care are prisoners in South Florida receiving? A researcher tells us about how bad it can sometimes be.
In sky is a break, they still can be seen. Shades of blue. And when the sun leads to the pool, I start anew.
Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Lewis Hernandez. A pregnant woman with mental illness delivered her child alone in a Broward County jail cell not too long ago. The woman says corrections personnel were aware that she was near term. She says personnel at the jail could hear her cries for help as she went into labor. In a letter to the Broward Sheriff's Office, Sheriff Gregory Tony, obtained by our news partners, the Miami Herald, the Broward County Public Defender Howard Finkelstein said this, quote, "It is unconscionable that any woman, particularly a mentally ill woman, would be abandoned in her cell to deliver her own baby," unquote. Lack of access to health care for inmates held in South Florida prisons and jails is not uncommon. A lawsuit was recently filed by the family of a Coral Springs man who, according to the suit, died a slow, painful, and preventable death. 9 other cases of Broward County jail deaths were listed in the suit as being preventable and caused by negligence. Joining me now is Dr. Tanya Zacherson. She's a former trauma surgeon at Jackson Memorial Hospital in Miami, where she researched why inmates die from treatable illnesses. Dr. Zacherson, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Luis. It's a pleasure to be here.
You had already been doing this research for some time on this issue. I'm wondering your reaction. You hear this story about this woman having to give birth to her own child in the cell. People are there. They hear her. They know what's going on. I mean, what was your reaction to this? I'm wondering if this is common or is this a rare story?
Right. So when I read about that story, obviously I had the same reaction that, you know, most human beings would have. It's shocking and horrifying. But at the same time, it does not surprise me. Luis, we have to keep in mind that when we're talking about incarcerated men, women, and youth in this country in particular, we're talking about millions of people, in particular 2.3 million. So it's the largest incarcerated population on earth, but they're the most vulnerable population that we have in this country, especially when it comes to patient care, in my opinion.
Do we have data, by the way, because I want to say, just sticking with this story of this woman, do we have data? Do we know, again, how many women are expecting who are incarcerated, who are in any situation similar to this case?
That's a very good question. I'm not aware of any data, because essentially when we capture data about who's incarcerated and what's going on behind bars, it's voluntary reporting. What I can comment on is the research we did, which worked backwards, using information about inmates that had already died while incarcerated and learning from their deaths what sort of situations they were facing. But in terms of people who are actually currently incarcerated, who needs medical attention, who is actually receiving the medical attention? Is that attention in a hospital, or is it in the prison infirmary, or are people left to their own devices within their own cells? We actually do not know, as far as I'm aware. There's no trauma, emergency general surgery, or any sort of surgical database that captures those data or that information.
Why were you interested in trying to learn more about this particular issue? Why did you want to dive into this?
I will be completely frank and honest with you. This actually was the brainchild of my public health student, Dr. Alex Busco, who was at the University of Miami at the time. And he came to me after learning about the death of Darren Rainey. You may remember Darren Rainey was, I think, a 51 or 52-year-old gentleman with schizophrenia who was incarcerated for a nonviolent drug crime. He became psychotic because he had no access to his medications. He started acting out in his cell, and as punishment, the guards put him in the shower, as it's called, and scalded him to death. So he was tortured to death. So my public health student was outraged with this, as he should be, as we all should be, and said, "I wonder how often this is happening, Tanya." And so we said, "Well, let's take a look. I don't know either. Let's take a look. It's a great question." So we went to the medical examiner's office, where the information is public there, and we said, "Let's do a review over 7 years and just look at all the incarcerated inmates who have died and see why they died. What was their cause of death as recorded by the medical examiner?"
And by the way, all that information, I mean, you know, how accurate was it? I'm wondering, like, if there was any information that was missing or anything that surprised you about what you were looking at the data.
So to follow up with that, actually, that's an excellent question. We were surprised with the results, you know, of our findings, which was essentially that close to 1 in 4 incarcerated inmate was dying because of preventable surgical or traumatic illness or injury. And only a third of those people were actually accessing surgical or had surgical intervention prior to dying. So what I'm talking about is cases of people dying from a groin hernia. That was one case that was recorded. Like, cause of death, inguinal hernia. And that really should not happen in anywhere in the United States.
Or, I mean, if somebody has that, then, I mean, because if you're seeing that and you're thinking that, wait a minute, that's treatable.
Correct.
Then what would have to happen for someone, for that situation to lead them to death then?
Gross negligence and a denial of surgical care, period. And what was even more concerning is because the date range of our study was between 2008 to 2014, we said, "Oh, Darren Rainey's chart will be included in this." So we looked for it, and we actually requested it because we knew he was part of the database, again, which was what prompted the study. And we were flat out denied access to his chart. And so what is concerning with that is if he died because he was tortured to death, how often is that happening to other inmates? What other charts are we missing and not getting access to? And so there's a whole bunch of questions that arise from this research, more than answers that are provided.
Was anybody able to give you any answer on that, though? Do we have any idea of how many cases we may not know about?
We do not. Not anything that anyone locally in Miami-Dade was willing to give. And then if you think about it on a national level, we have the Bureau of Justice Statistics that collects data on incarcerated individuals from 50 states, and they look at who's died and whatnot. But all of that reporting is voluntary. And the variability between what states are reporting what is phenomenal. So we actually have no clear idea as to who is dying while they're incarcerated and what they're dying from and who's dying violent deaths as a result of mistreatment, abuse, neglect, or negligence, or just not accessing care in a timely fashion. It's very, very difficult to know, even though these are extremely basic questions involving human rights.
And you talked about some of the different cases that you saw, at least what had been reported. Did anything really jump out at you? Was there anything shocking?
I think the most shocking thing was that we're dealing with like 51% of our patient population had mental illness. But what was shocking was that we were seeing cases like literally like groin hernias or bowel obstructions as listed as causes of death, stab wound to the abdomen, things that really, you know, if you access surgical or medical treatment in a timely fashion, no one should be dying from this at all.
I'm talking with Dr. Tanya Zacherson. She's a former trauma surgeon at Jackson Memorial Hospital in Miami. And last year, her and a group of researchers from the University of Miami studied a number of autopsy reports, as we've been talking about now, and found that inmates in Miami-Dade County jails and prisons die in part because they lack adequate access to timely health care. Lots of questions about how people are dying in those prisons. So, you know what, Dr. Zacherson, then, you know, we look at this, and I guess the first question that comes to mind for me is this: what kind of health care do prisoners have exactly? Can we tell from the data what's available?
That's an excellent question. Sadly, we cannot, because again, we're working backwards. These are death reports, if you will. So it's hard to know. I know there's variability with what's available on a jail level, what's available on a state prison level or federal prison level. Normally, when an inmate is injured or unwell, they will be transported to Jackson Memorial Hospital, or they should come into the hospital.
What about when you start with the first thing, the first layer, I guess, which is the infirmary. But what is in the infirmary? What do they have access to there before they go to a hospital?
So an infirmary would be like a basic clinic, as far as I understand. And I'm not an expert of healthcare within the prison system at all. But it certainly is not something like a hospital where you could access, where you would have access to surgical intervention. Like you would have someone to a surgeon to operate on you, or an anesthesiologist to care for you. Like, it's not set up that way. It's just basic first aid type of things. And then I think the infirmary would be really where the decision is made. You know what, this patient isn't getting better. They need to go actually be transported to the hospital, or they are improving. They can go back to their cell. The question is how many people actually make it to the infirmary, or from the infirmary to the hospital, or just stay in their cell. We do not know.
Does the data tell you in how many cases the patient needed surgery?
We think it does. Again, we're dealing with unverified data. We're going based on what the medical examiner has written. But when we're seeing all of the cases of surgical illness or trauma, and we know that these cases required surgery to help the patient and save the patient, and when we're seeing that only a third of those patients who died actually received the indicated surgical procedure, that becomes a problem. Now, it could be that all of the patients actually received surgical interventions and just it wasn't recorded properly. We don't know, but it's kind of suspicious and concerning.
Does the data tell us anything about perhaps a disparity in treatment for people, based on their gender or race?
So that's also an interesting question, Luis. Our patient population that we studied, our cohort, as we call it, was very reflective of the prison population in the United States. So locally in Miami-Dade County, our cohort was largely male, but they were disproportionately men of color. So 40% were Black, considered, again, Haitian, African-American, or Black Hispanic. And that's double, I think, the local population in Miami. And then another 40% were Hispanic. So this is a reflection, again, of the larger problem we have in the United States of mass incarceration of both men and women of color.
Do we know, and I know that because you mentioned to me a second ago that you don't know all the inner workings of healthcare within the system, but I'm curious also if you do about funding for healthcare coverage available to inmates. What do we know is supposed to be available to them? Do we have any idea of that?
So by statutes and laws, actually, that have gone up to the Supreme Court, we know that men and women who are incarcerated have the right to health care, and that's any health care that's required or needed, whether it's surgical intervention, if they need an operation, if they need antibiotics or any care. They have the right to all care that any other human being would have the right to. So that's stipulated. What they actually receive, again, I just don't think anyone really knows.
Now, I mean, you had this data that you looked at, but you've also, I mean, as a surgeon, as a doctor, you've worked with inmates treating them.
Correct.
I wondered if you ever talked to them or if you had the chance to hear what they told you about what life was like and healthcare was like behind bars.
So that's also a very good question. And of course, there are anecdotal stories that come to mind, again, non-scientific and non-quantified, but cases of, you know, young men who have had previous surgery, who have had bowel obstructions. That's where their intestines get kinked or knotted because of scar tissue on the inside, and you become very sick, you start to vomit, and you become very dry or dehydrated. But I remember in particular one young man in clinic who came in, and he was having ongoing abdominal pain. We ended up admitting him because we knew that he wouldn't be, you know, properly treated back in prison, and he needed support and fluids and treatment. But he told me the story about how he had been writhing around on the floor of the infirmary in prison for hours and hours prior to being transported in, and that there was a definite delay. Now, he didn't die, obviously. So I think our study points to the larger question. If our study has shown that two-thirds of inmates that required surgical intervention to survive did not receive that, how many more are being harmed? Or what is, that's the mortality part, but what is the morbidity or simply harm part of people who don't even die? How prevalent is that of, just like this patient I was talking to who was saying, you know, I was left on the floor for hours writhing around in pain. Because who are they going to call? 911 to get an ambulance? They're the most vulnerable patient population we have in this country.
Is this research going to continue? Because one of the things that I mentioned is you're leaving.
I'm going to University of Chicago, yes.
The Windy City. You're leaving sunny South Florida for the Windy City.
Yes.
But, I mean, congratulations on that. But will this research continue?
It will, because the study we did is actually the first of its kind, as far as we know. So again, it's a patient population that's highly the most vulnerable, but also very, very understudied. So we are definitely carrying on with this research up in Chicago. I have a lot of colleagues up in Chicago, other trauma surgeons there too, that are very interested in looking into this. And it also, it just raises questions about all urban centers and cities across the country. Like what we're seeing in Miami-Dade County, I do not believe is unique only to Miami-Dade County. And we're probably seeing this, and we will probably expect to see this across the board as we continue this research.
You know, the other thing too, I mean, I'm thinking next steps here is even with the information that you have gathered, I mean, has it gotten to any state officials, local officials? Has it gotten to the people who can actually do something about it? How do we get that information to their hands at least?
Well, so that's a deeper political question, yeah. And that's a very good question. My personal opinion is that I think on a very local level, there's not necessarily much change that it can occur. It should occur, of course, but once again, we're dealing with the most incarcerated population, the largest incarcerated population on earth. So we have 500,000 more incarcerated individuals in this country than they do in China, which has a population of 1.2 billion. What's going on in Miami-Dade is going on in other parts of Florida. It's going on in California. It's going on in New York City. It's going on in Chicago. This is a like systemic problem that needs addressing on a far larger scale. So I would take it up to the top as we approach 2020 and really think that this is a phenomenal human rights issue that affects so many individuals in this country, both men and women, and take it at that level.
Again, talking with Dr. Tanya Zacherson, former trauma surgeon at Jackson Memorial Hospital in Miami. You can learn more about her study on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Again, fascinating looking at this data and just asking the question, again, what sort of health care do inmates have? Not just in Miami-Dade, but throughout the country, as she pointed out. And stories like the ones that we've pointed out kind of do make you think about that. Dr. Zacherson, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Luis, for having me.
Good luck to you again as you head off to your new adventure.
Thank you so much.
All right. Still to come, we're going to go down to the Florida Keys for a story about a hotel fire and charges of a businessman tossing construction trash into the ocean. More on that coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, this past weekend, the newly opened Bungalows Resort in Key Largo suffered a significant blow. The only all-inclusive resort in the Keys lost its main building to a massive fire. Fortunately, no one was hurt in the blaze, but the business suffered significant damages. The Miami Herald's David Goodhue covered the story. He's also here to tell us about a proposed eco-tourist resort in Isla Mirada and why the developer behind it is now facing charges from the U.S. Attorney's Office. David, great to have you, man. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. The Bungalows, relatively new development in the Keys. Explain what they are. Who are they catered to?
It's an adults-only, all-inclusive resort, and it opened in December. It was there was a campground before there. There's a lot of things in that lot before they came there. It's opened by the people that own Chica Lodge in the Keys, and who ironically had a similar fire in 2008, which burned down the whole resort.
Wow. This started, what, back at Sunday morning early, right?
Yeah, about 4:30 in the morning.
Yeah, and so one of the visitors, I believe, Corey Honeback, I hope I'm saying the name right, essentially ultimately helped in putting out the blaze. Tell me what's going on here.
Well, the state fire marshal is investigating. We're not sure where it started. I'm hearing a lot of things here. Hearing things that might have started from a food truck. The whole second story of that building was made of like a tiki thatch roof, which goes up pretty quick. And that's actually what happened in the Chica Lodge fire back in 08. That was ultimately determined. Someone threw a cigarette from their room, from their balcony, and then the whole thing went up.
And there's video up. I mean, different people had got videos and photos that also were up online. Again, this is under investigation. Help us understand, you know, like the setup. I did Google map this just to see how big it is. There is the main building and then, of course, the bungalows, right?
And so, 135 of them.
Yeah, so it's just the main building that's in the front that was destroyed.
Yeah, the fire department was able to isolate it to just that building.
Do we have any idea how long it's going to take to rebuild that, reopen? Or, I mean, are they going to be able to run any business, or is it closed?
No, it's closed. They put out a statement yesterday that they're going to shoot for December of this year.
For December? Mm-hmm. That's a quick turnaround.
Yeah, I mean, who knows if that's going to happen. But
do we have a sense of, because this is so new, what the economic impact this resort was supposed to have for Key Largo?
It was pretty significant because Key Largo didn't get hit as bad as Isla Mirada did in the hurricane, but they lost the big Hilton Resort there, which just reopened, actually. I mean, Isla Mirada, everything on the ocean side, some of the big ones, including, not to mention Chica again, the Islander Resort, Amara Cay, they all got wiped out by the oceanside surge. Key Largo was largely spared from that, but they did lose... But I mean, anything in the Upper Keys. I mean, any lodging, any big lodging they lose is going to have a significant economic impact.
You know, it's interesting. You think about new developments in the Keys don't happen that often. There's just a lot of regulation and there's just a hesitancy to build new big projects. But I wonder, did this one face any resistance, or did people were people excited about this?
People were excited about it by and large. I mean, any hotel is going to bring jobs, bring people into town. I mean, the Keys relies on tourism. So there wasn't too much resistance to this.
I'm talking with David Goodhue, reporter for the Miami Herald and Florida Keys News. On Sunday, a large fire took out the main building of the new Bungalows Resort in Key Largo, which just opened this past December. Goodhue has also been following another story I want to talk about a tourist resort in the Keys. It hasn't happened, but there was a plan for it. There was this proposal. I think this goes back quite a bit now, quite a few years, to build an eco-tourist lodge in Isla Mirada. All right, so tell us about this. This is from Coral Springs developer Bonefish Holdings. What is this?
Yeah, it's Bonefish Holdings is pretty much a doctor, Albert Vorsman, from Coral Springs, and he owns a property down there that I think originally he was going to build something, build a house on it. It's zoned for residential. Then he got hooked up with this landscape architectural firm in Fort Lauderdale, and they had this grand plan, and this firm actually built similar ambitious ecotourism resorts all over the world.
Yeah.
And I think they had a large hand in building a lot of what's in Atlantis now in the Bahamas.
What is, by the way, what's an ecotourist resort supposed to be?
It's
different.
It's actually similar to what burned down. There would be bungalow type housing throughout the property. They would restore a lot of the native vegetation. There'd be a lot of trees, natural wetlands.
It's not your typical,
like, not like a
hotel,
exactly.
Big building. It's separate. Okay,
it's sprawled out.
Why was there resistance for this project?
The traffic, really. I think that's what it came down to. I think the residents were nervous about how that would impact traffic flow throughout Isla Mirada, which does back up. I mean, anyone who's been to the Keys on the weekends, you could be driving, you could be humming along, and then all of a sudden when you get to the village, which is the four island incorporated town in the Upper Keys, once you get through there, even though that's the only place with four lanes,
right,
it backs up.
But at the same time, I wondered, did it have any public support? Because, I mean, as you said with the other project, the bungalows, I mean, it's jobs.
It's jobs. Isla Mirada is a little different. Key Largo, the bungalows is in Key Largo, which is unincorporated Monroe County. The Bonefish Holdings development was going to happen in Isla Mirada, which is incorporated. It's village council meetings, which, I mean, there's an active civic life there. And people made it known that they didn't want that. Now, this is right around the time also where they proposed a Publix, which eventually did get built. But even the Publix, I mean, people in the Keys have to go very far, well, did have to go very far to get shopping that we're used to. And the Publix faced the similar backlash because of traffic again.
All right. So this gentleman, Vorsman, he's charged with allegedly dumping massive amounts of materials. This in the weeks following Hurricane Irma. What is he charged with dumping? What was he allegedly dumping?
Well, that's the charges. I mean, that's the way that they word it. In reality, what it is, he cleared his property. He illegally cleared his property, and the property technically is wetlands. So the vegetation, rock, anything he dug up ended up in the wetlands. So that's why he got charged with dumping into the waters of the United States.
And, I mean, you have to have permission to do this.
Absolutely.
Did anybody see what he was doing?
Apparently somebody did and turned him in.
All right. No, I just wonder if they had caught him beforehand. But
No.
If the allegations are true, I mean, what was his incentive to do this? Was it the cost of cleanup or what? What, you know, do we know?
I don't know. He did not comment. His attorney just said that they're working with the government for the charges. And basically, I think what happened was, which would happen with a lot of people in the Keys, they used the hurricane as an excuse to get rid of things on their land.
I wondered if you'd seen that before, if they had,
yeah,
you know, used the disaster as the way to clear out unwanted stuff.
Absolutely. Happened a lot.
So the U.S. Attorney's Office, as you said, filed the charges in federal court. They're working things out right now. He's not even in the country.
No, right? When I got a hold of him, he was headed to New Zealand, which is where he's from.
What could he face?
5 years probation and I think a $500,000 fine.
And I take it the project's probably
dead
at this point. I wanted to ask you about something else, something a little personal, because this happened to you last year. This is a story, and I think it goes to your passion for the work, but it also tells us something about life in the Keys. It's a little bit different. You were attacked working on a story last year, after the recovery of Irma, I should say. And you wrote about this for the Herald. You were attacked by a bulldog.
No, it wasn't a bulldog. It was a Canary Mastiff.
Oh, Canary Mastiff. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. What happened?
I was going down to do, this was actually this past November, right after Thanksgiving. And it was an Irma-related story. It was a business owner whose business never recovered after Irma. He had a lot of complaints about why that was. He owned a boatyard, and I went to interview him in the boatyard. His dog greeted me first as I opened up my car door. I didn't think anything of it. I mean, it was a big dog. It turned out it was a 165-pound dog. But he had his head in my car door as I was still talking to the owner, still sitting behind the wheel. And owner went to shake my hand. I went to shake his hand. I think that set the dog off. He attacked, pushed me into my passenger seat and basically ripped my a large part of my face off. My nose. I had to get reconstructed using the skin from my forehead to rebuild my nose, which I don't know. I think it looks a lot better. I mean, it looks like I got in a car accident now instead of, you know, that my nose. I don't know if you could tell my nose was actually at one point removed.
Well, it was. And we'd seen pictures.
Yeah. You know, it broke my hand as well. They used parts of my forehead, parts of my ear to rebuild everything.
Yeah, it's not to say this is the worst thing that's happened to you, but at the same time in your job, I mean, you have faced threats. Somebody came at you with a machete once?
Yeah, that was last year, two Super Bowls now. It was a murder in Homestead. A woman murdered her baby, and we was there to interview neighbors, went to interview, and I saw one man walking. And I asked him if he knew the people, and yes, he said, "Oh yeah, I did." He goes, "Can you follow me though?" And I walked a step ahead of him, and a car pulled up, and these women got out of the car, and they yelled at him to stop what he was going. They begged him not to do it. And I turned around, and he had a machete, and he was ready to swing it, and he just started to laugh, and he got in the car and left.
Things like this, does it make you think twice about what you're doing?
No, I mean, for the most part, and I think I put that in the column. I mean, it's very. I mean, I love what I do, but I mean, it's, you know, normally it's going to village council meetings and or city council meetings, school board meetings, going through court papers, interviewing very nice people. I mean, it's a very safe job, I think, for the most part. I think any job being from a postman to a policeman to a utility worker who has to show up at someone's house that they don't know faces similar dangers.
I know that, you know, from reading the story of the dog attack, and I was trying to picture it. You were still in your car,
yeah.
And it jumped in,
yeah,
with you at that point. What's happened to that dog, by the way?
I don't know. The county ordered it out of the county or euthanized. The owner wanted to not euthanize it, argued for him to let it keep it, but the judge said he had to go out. Last I heard, he took it to Georgia somewhere.
Have you talked to the owner? Have you talked?
Not in a while.
No?
Yeah.
You know, I just wondered, you know, again, I know it's true, as you said, that the job is relatively safe, but sometimes we do put ourselves in situations,
yeah.
You know, and I'd wondered if, you'd ever heard anything like this before from any of your peers.
No, not that working in the United States.
I agree with you because I have reporter friends who do go to places that I can't even imagine. That I probably couldn't do myself. David Goodhue, again, reporter for the Miami Herald and the Florida Keys News. You can find links to his recent stories on our website, WLRN.org. David, always a pleasure. Thank
Likewise.
You so much.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate it. I do want to remind you, by the way, real quickly, that we do have a book club. If you have not joined our book club, please do so. Why haven't you by this point? Join our book club. You can find us on Facebook at WLRN Sundial. In recognition of Haitian Heritage Month, we are diving into the fascinating novel Dancing in the Baron's Shadow by Fabienne Josephat. Again, find us on Facebook, WLRN Sundial Book. Ask to join. It's free. We'd love to have you join us. And, of course, we always want to know what you're reading. As summer is coming up, we are definitely going to be asking you soon about your favorite summer reads. Now, coming up next week on Sundial, have you ever been caught texting and driving? We will explain the repercussions of the new law expected to be signed by the governor, and we want to hear your thoughts about it. Plus, author Dave Barry joins us to explain what he's learned about life from his dog. It's the premise of his new book. And speaking of new books, again, don't forget about our Sundial Book Club. And our book this month is Dancing in the Baron's Shadow by Fabienne Josephat. Remember, you can always find us online, WLRN.org. You can always find us on social media, Twitter and Facebook at WLRN Sundial. We always love to hear your thoughts of the program or anything that's going on in your neck of the woods. We cover South Florida from Palm Beach County all the way down to the Keys. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful Friday. Have a great weekend. We'll talk to you again on Monday.
let the storm winds blow. You are.